Chapter 2. Negativity. I know some people, too many of them really, who seem to be in a perpetually bad mood. These people drift along, frequent sighs having replaced anything akin to wind in their sails. They have somehow managed to find the worst jobs with the meanest bosses and most backstabbing co-workers. Asking, "How are you?" is met with a tragic roll of eyes and sucking of teeth. The quaver in the opening word of the reply, "Well," indicates that you will not escape anytime soon, but will be subjected to a lengthy and painstaking tale of woe. It seems that whenever I run into one of these people, they have coincidentally just that morning had some streak of catastrophic bad luck or other. Despite their obviously tragic circumstances, they report that their unfeeling family and so-called friends continue to criticize, hurt, and reject them. Traffic jams, illness, and botched orders at the drive-thru are attracted to these people like dirty cosmic magnets. I feel badly for these people, but it is not because of some plight with which they've been cursed. I feel badly for them because they have unnecessarily spent so many unhappy years with a continual knot in their stomach. The best advice so far? Being miserable is a choice. Some of you just got mad. My short piece of advice feels like judgment to you. You're telling yourself that I don't understand and that this is a generalization, that your circumstances are far more complex or a special case. At least hear me out. Then you will have all the information, even if it is only to better fuel your anger toward me in the end. Might as well make your fire a doozy. Or maybe it will be the unimaginable. Happiness. Freedom. Peace. If you will at least entertain the possibility, then you've already chosen to put your foot in the door to a better place. I recently saw a short video about a man named Nick. As the video begins, the camera is zoomed in on Nick's face. He is a young, handsome man with a cool Australian accent. Then again, to Americans, an Australian accent is always cool. His voice is warm and friendly. You instantly like Nick. You know somehow without a doubt that whatever he may be about to say, he is not acting. Nick announces that he likes to swim, boat, play golf. It almost seems like a dating advertisement. After the short list, which manages to include long walks on the beach, Nick finishes his greeting. "I love life. I am happy." The camera zooms out. Nick is on a couch. Nick has no arms or legs. Well, he has something there where a leg should be, one small misshapen appendage, which he later refers to as his chicken wing. Nick's list of things he loves to do quickly takes on new meaning from this angle. In a montage sequence, we see Nick on the grass in front of a soccer goal. A ball goes flying over his head into the net. "I wasn't ready," he exclaims, with a feigned look of childlike excuse. Next, we watch as Nick runs, yes, runs without legs, down the field. He balances a soccer ball on his head, far longer than I can. He sloshes down a water slide, surfs, steers a motorboat with his chin, dives into a swimming pool, plays golf, again, far better than I can. But the purpose of Nick's video is not to illustrate some one-in-a-billion scientific anomaly. There are no doctor's testimonials saying, "We don't know why this man can do these things. It should be impossible given his condition." The purpose of Nick's video is to tell others that being miserable is a choice. And that conversely, happiness is also a choice. Nick is an international motivational speaker who tells his story so that the very same advice I've given you here has a voice that's difficult to argue with. But it's still the same advice. True is true. Nick doesn't paint some Pollyanna picture of his life. We see aides having to pick him up and move him onto a stage or an interview chair. He talks openly about having tried to drown himself in a bathtub at the age of 8, because he saw his life having no possibility for happiness. He would never be married. No one would love him that way. He was a drain on his parents and society. Nick had every circumstantial reason to be miserable. And for a while, he was. Understand that his circumstances didn't change. He did not get prosthetic limbs. He still needs help in the bathroom, I'm guessing. But something changed, that much is certain. He took the exact same circumstances he'd been handed and decided, if I'm going to live, I'm not going to live like this. He did not get happier after learning to run or swim. He learned to run and swim because he decided to start being happier. And happiness breeds hope. He has found a purpose for his life, successfully encouraging hundreds of thousands of people to believe that life is what you make it, that you can always get back up and try again. Nick is not an isolated case. I know many such people. A friend of mine, Anindya, has been deaf and blind since childhood. He was not born deaf and blind. He lost his hearing gradually due to a degenerative condition. He lost the sight in each eye in separate random accidents in his native country of India. Talk about grounds for bitterness. But he's one of the happiest people I have ever met. He travels the world unaided except by his dog. He completed an advanced degree and holds a high-ranking teaching position. He is an inventor. He is probably the smartest person I know, and he is married and very much in love. Maybe this is a good time to bring it back to you. If you've got the miserable bug bad, you probably heard those stories and felt some negative emotion. How did they figure out how to be happy when I can't? I'm a terrible person. I'm selfish, so I guess I deserve the miserable life I have, and man, am I miserable. Just this morning, I blew a tire and off it goes down that path again. I was just talking with my niece about a woman we both know. I commented to this mother about how impressed I was with her toddler's memory. He's a bright one. He's sitting in there quoting the movie we watched last night, line for line. In an Eeyore-like voice, she replied, "Yeah, great. That's because he's seen it a million times. He drives me crazy." Now, is her 2-year-old intelligent, exhibiting solid memory and language skills at an early age? Or is he obsessive and annoying? My best friend, Dib, is famous for putting it this way. The only prize for being the most miserable is... congratulations, you're the most miserable. Applaud here, then extend invisible interview mic. Tell us, how does it feel? You must be so proud. The nub of it is that there is no gain to being miserable. You're just miserable. I remember a story I heard once about a young mother baking a ham. She cut substantial-sized portions off the end of the ham and set them aside. Then she basted the remaining center portion, dressed it, and placed it in the oven. "Why do you cut the ends off?" her inquisitive 6-year-old daughter asked. The mother paused, then replied, "That's just the way we always did it." "But why?" pressed the little girl unexpectedly. "Run along and play," the mother replied. But she was bothered at her own lack of any real answer. Her family had always done it that way. She called her own mother. "Mom, I'm baking a ham, and I cut the ends off as usual, but why did we always cut the ends off?" There was a silence on the line, followed by, "I don't really know. We just always did it that way in my family. The call ended there. But the burning question lingered. The young woman now called her grandmother. Hi, Grandma. I have an odd question. Why do we cut the ends off the ham before we put it in the oven? Goodness me, replied her grandmother. I can't imagine why you do it. I only did it because my oven was too small to fit a whole ham. Consider this carefully. We do virtually nothing in life without some sort of perceived gain. A man trapped by a fallen boulder while climbing endures the horror of cutting his own arm off with a small knife because he believes there is a gain, survival. Likewise, we complain, focus on the negative, or respond with sarcasm because there is a perceived gain. Understand that I said perceived gain. Like the young mother in the anecdote, we often get ourselves into situations where we have long since stopped asking what the gain is. However, if we were to spend some thoughtful time answering this question, we may be forced to realize that the end result we were after isn't being achieved. Maybe it has never been achieved, and that means we've simply been wasting a whole lot of precious energy that could have been expended in more productive ways. Maybe for you, this answer to the question of gains will rise to the surface. I want people to pay attention to me. I never got attention as a kid, except for when I was very sick. And so somewhere along the way, sickness and the collecting of other dire circumstances became your only hope for being taken seriously and getting the attention a child craves. A helpful realization, but ask yourself, am I, in fact, getting more affirming attention from people with my complaining and negative outlook? The answer is likely no. The answer is more likely that people actually avoid your company or don't often call looking to spend time with you. The intended goal is not being achieved. My aim in this particular book is not to give a case-by-case rundown of all psychological possibilities for what unachieved goals are driving each person's negative emotions and perceptions. It is only to say that there is ample support and research, not to mention countless testimonials, to say that circumstances are not the problem. Choices regarding focus and behavior are. And those can be changed with diligence and perhaps a little help from others. I add my own life to the testimonials, and I hope that some of the principles in this book will provide solid suggestions for change. So where do you start? How do you change what may perhaps be a lifetime of feeling like a victim? Old habits die hard. They won't change overnight, that much is sure. But they can change. The first step would be to accept that you have become a negative person, and that life or other people are not to blame. This is also the start of embracing that you are part of the solution. Not quite convinced that your problem is all that serious? Ask the three people closest to you, don't lead the witness, using phrases like, you don't see me as a negative person, do you? Ask neutrally, border on begging for an honest response. I need to ask you something. It's serious, and I need you to tell me the truth. I will not argue with whatever your answer is, I just need to know what you think. Do you see me as a negative person? Then just listen. Be aware that, from people who love you, the answers you get may be tempered. What do you mean by negative? Or, I might say you're more serious than negative exactly. Take anything but, no, of course not, as, yes, you tend to be negative. Breathe. Here comes the hard part that will bring you face to face with finding out what those perceived gains of yours are. Tell the people in your life that you are committing to stop being negative, miserable, sarcastic, a complainer. Tell the people to whom you complain most, tell them that you are resolved not to dwell on negative things any longer, but to focus on the positive. Give them permission to call you out on it when you slip. If you really consider doing this, you may find yourself thinking things like, I can't do that. If I tell them, I won't be able to blank anymore. What you fill into that blank is likely your perceived gain. I won't be able to get my kids to do what I want them to do anymore. I won't be able to pass the blame for my own failures anymore. I won't have a reason for people to feel bad for me anymore, and that's the closest I feel to loved. But again, ask yourself, is your perceived goal being met by the negativity anyway? Likely not. The kids ignore you when you gripe and nag. Others aren't keeping you from the consequences of your shortcomings. Complaining doesn't leave you feeling loved. So commit to your new course of action. Tell people, and then set a new goal, an achievable goal. Spend time with your kids. Make it your goal to listen to them and understand what's important to them. Make it your goal to gain new job-related or interpersonal skills. Make it your goal to spread cheer and hope to others. As soon as you realize you are getting negative, even if it's only in your mind, stop yourself and admit it. If you are in conversation, admit it out loud. You know what? I just realized I'm complaining and focusing on the bad here. I'm really trying to be more positive, so I'm not even going to finish that story. Don't give in just because the other person offers that you have to vent sometime or it's okay with a good friend like me. It isn't okay. Even if they are content to listen to it, complaining isn't helping you to achieve your goal of peaceful and happy living. It is just keeping the old cycle going, the cycle that you are now committed to breaking. Understand here that being negative isn't an all or nothing state. I consider myself a very positive person, but I still have my things that pull me toward moping or complaining. Just the other day, I was running this chapter by my friend Chad, who is probably the most positive person I know. And still, we both were able to notice in one another areas or times when we give in to being negative. There is always room for growth, for redirecting wasted energies into more positive pursuits. I'd also like to say that, like Nick, you may have legitimately difficult circumstances. But Nick realized at some point early on that what he wanted was arms and legs, a normal life. And it became clear to him that being sad and angry wasn't going to give him those things. So he changed his goal. He decided that rather than pining for the normal life of those who have all their limbs, he would pursue a different goal, a life of purpose. That goal was achievable with specific action. And having positive, achievable goals paired with a specific plan of action to reach them will change our outlook on life.